Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to the Idle Red Hands. I'm Lyle.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Alan.
Did you guys hear that Carmen Belair attempted suicide?
I did not. I heard that from you.
Did you know who Carmen Belair was?
Should I know who he is?
Not necessarily. I think his big thing was going to be something that was upcoming, which is the Rifts board game. I don't know if it's on Kickstarter. It's coming on a Kickstarter or was coming on Kickstarter. Are you guys familiar with what's going on with Palladium and the Robotech RPG Tactics?
No.
So I read a little bit what you posted, but it just seems like it's a bit of a mess and a lot of people were upset.
Yeah, there was a Kickstarter 4 years ago for a miniatures game based on the Robotech property, and it was produced by Palladium, who also did the Robotech RPGs in North America. And they released some of the stuff, and I guess there's this thing called Wave 2, and the only reason I really know about this is because I like the Palladium Books Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever they post an update, like, oh, here's the new Rifter, and somebody goes, where's Wave 2? Where's Wave 2? You know, like a lot of comments. Like, if there's 10 comments, 8 of them will be, where's Wave 2 kind of thing. This Carmen guy decided to jump in on this Kickstarter comments group and say, hey, I'm coming out with this Rifts board game. I was somewhat involved with the Robotech thing, but not too much. And, you know, if you guys kind of back off on the board game, like don't trash it, then it'll be a success and it'll show Kevin Simbeta, he's the owner operator of Palladium Books, it will show him that I can deliver on a Palladium property, therefore I'll be able to take over the Robotech property and give you your what you've been waiting for, as well as improving the rules or something like that. So he posted this thing. It wasn't exactly the most diplomatically worded post. People were not happy with it and commented on it, and then at some point I guess he just, you know, he'd had enough or he was stressed and decided to take his own life. His wife intervened.
Wow.
So he's in the hospital and he's alive. It's great.
So I guess it was like pills or something like that?
I don't know. I don't know. He's in the hospital. I don't know if it was pills or... It's a bit of a downer to start off with, and there's the specifics of the case is they are what they are. But, you know, a broader topic is just about Kickstarters in general. Yeah, both the stress on the part of the people have to deliver, the stress or the on the part of the customer if they don't get something delivered. Have you guys backed something that didn't get delivered?
Yes, kind of. It's going to be delivered. Like, for example, I backed the new Hollow Earth Expedition Adventure Series. They're still working on it.
The Mars one was quite late.
The Mars, they sent me the book, but now they're working on the adventure book.
So, oh, was that promised in the same Kickstarter?
Yeah, so the thing is, it was another Kickstarter that came out after Mars, and it was to kind of produce this series of adventures. And they did the same thing with Secrets of the Surface World, I believe. The guy, he's on saying that he's really busy, but he hasn't done anything with your money, your money's safe. He delivered all of the other rewards, and then he's going to deliver the book, but he's talking about how he can upload them as PDFs or something first, and it seems to be a bit of a mess of sorts. I haven't checked the comment sections. I'm not really all that bothered by it, just because I've backed enough Kickstarters, and they come in at various times, you know, so...
Right.
Mm. Yeah, so that's kind of one... you know, sometimes Level 99 comes out with really big Kickstarters, and they take a little bit longer than mentioned to produce to their full extent.
I think that's pretty standard. They take longer than is mentioned or planned.
Yeah. I think anybody that's doing manufacturing in China, it's very random and schedules. You know, they don't promise you anything, and you're lucky, you're happy when you get it. My worst experience on Kickstarter was the Dust Babylon expansion, so the North African kind of desert campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So they had recently, the license ended with Fantasy Flight. They had a new distributor. After the Kickstarter had finished, they started fighting over the money and who was going to pay for what, and their original agreement completely fell apart, and so nobody got anything except things that were already produced, so maybe things that were warehoused. Some people got nothing, and people have been kind of sporadically promised things, but there was a big kind of war back and forth, and now the rights to Dust are just completely in the hands of the owner, and they're working based completely out of China, so everyone was pretty unhappy, and I think the reputation of that game itself like really took a beating because you know, it was the creator and a new distributor that were working together, and things just fell apart, and I think bad behavior possibly on both parties' ends ended up not getting people anything that they were promised, or some people random things. I think an agreement was finalized, and so things are eventually going to be sent out to everybody. But yeah, it was pretty bad. It was really ruined the reputation of a really fun game, a really fun, weird World War II game that had an okay following, and that now people are just scared away. There's a lot of miniature games that you could actually use your old Dust miniatures for.
Okay, yeah.
Because people know that
Dust... why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Dust fell apart.
Mm. For the most part, the Kickstarters that I've backed have been well managed and properly delivered on time, you know.
In the case of Palladium, they have a bit of a reputation for delivering on their role-playing books late, or role-playing books that they promise never actually materializing. So when they offer a Kickstarter promising all of these things, obviously it's appealing to Robotech fans, sure, but Palladium fans as well. But you got to be a bit of aware of the company's background and their history. So if they fooled you once on one thing, I mean, they fooled you twice on this Kickstarter. I mean, you know, who's at fault?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it is a bit of a gold rush, you know, especially with board games and I guess now video games too, that, you know, they've seen people get millions of dollars and they think, well, this is the way to do it, and don't realize the production costs and shipping and what's actually going to happen to you if you overpromise. You're going to actually owe money. You know, you've taken in millions of dollars in pledges and you're actually going to owe money after the whole thing is over.
There's always these stories where they didn't factor in shipping, which is part of everything. And I'm seeing now with a lot of Kickstarters, they actually don't factor in the shipping and the price. And they'll say, we'll charge you shipping afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And shipping can actually change.
Mm, right.
So yeah, I know Chris pledged Blue Rose. And what you bought, they said, like, shipping will be separate and we'll tell you later. And the shipping was quite dear 2 years later. They're going to be able to deliver on the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually pledged it on his behalf. And I saw the price of the shipping was over $50.
Oh, wow.
So it's over $50. You still want it? Because I've got to actually now add that to my credit card. He's like, oh, yeah, I guess. I'm like, are you still interested in this game? You haven't mentioned it at all in 2 years, but yeah. He's like, yeah, sure, yeah, let's do it.
I guess that's a part of it. You know, some of these Kickstarters take a long time to fulfill by the time they roll around, you know. A lot of people just kind of forgot about them. And as you said, things change, you know, with this Hollow Earth. They already shipped me some of my rewards, and that's included in the price that I've already paid for shipping.
Right.
So they're going to have to ship me my other book, and the shipping's going to be on them. Same thing happened with Level 99 with this Millennium Blades game, you know. They sent the base game, and they're sending the expansion separate. It took them about a year or two longer to actually produce this expansion. And, you know, I paid shipping for the expansion, and, you know, they were going to ship it together, but they can't now. And that's, a lot of people are in the same boat, so I think they're just eating the cost.
One of the things that's very curious about Kickstarters, and especially living in Japan, a lot of the board game components and miniatures and things are produced in China. Sometimes it's a big advantage to be living in Asia, and sometimes they haven't worked out the shipping, so it actually goes to North America, and then it's shipped from fulfillment centers in North America back to Asia. So you actually have to wait. So sometimes you're the first person to get anything in a Kickstarter, and sometimes you're the last. So it's very...
I've never been the first. Yeah. I've always been at the tail end.
You know, Deadlands. Pinnacle Entertainment is taking back the Deadlands IP, and they just announced kind of big news, really.
What were they doing in between releasing Deadlands and what was the one that came out after Deadlands? Something Earth? Wasted Earth? And then other people started producing Deadlands.
AEG picked up the Doomtown, which was the, you know, the Deadlands IP.
Right.
And then they canned it. Pinnacle took it. They didn't want to renew it, and Pinnacle took it back or something like that. So now in their recent Kickstarter, they just announced that they're going to continue the Doomtown LCG.
Right.
ECG, whatever you want to call it. And that seems to be a big news for people in general, because it does have a pretty strong yet cult fan base. I don't know. I'm kind of excited about that, because I really like the Doomtown LCG. And I you know, I never got into the CCG version of it, but, you know, I like how it plays. And Jeremy, you and I played it quite a bit. I would love to play it more, but it's just, you know, unfortunately no one plays it. And here we are in Japan, and, you know, it's up to us to teach other people, but yet there are other LCGs that are being played.
Mm-hmm. So our topic today is going to be LCGs, living card games. So what are they?
They are an addiction.
One of the reasons why we wanted to do this episode is that Netrunner actually brought us all together.
Yeah.
So maybe it's an indulgent episode, but bear with us. So what we'd like to do is talk about the games that are still in existence, mm-hmm. talking about how you would get started and the advantages or disadvantages of that.
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, I guess getting started, first question everyone asks is how much?
Right, yeah. What cards do I have to buy? What do I have to do to actually be able to play this game?
I mean, the easy, simple answer is you're just going to buy a core set, pretty much. And a lot of people do, and it turns into a board game for them, you know, a very fixed card pool.
So you're thinking about getting started in LCG. Now, the LCG is actually a trademark term for Fantasy Flight games, and they produce the majority of this style of card game. Of course, you still have games like Magic the Gathering, which follow the different model of the collectible card game. And I don't think in 2017 we're going to be adding anything to the Magic the Gathering discussion. If somebody is interested in starting an LCG or buying an LCG, Jeremy, what would their choices be?
Right now, the kind of big sellers and active LCGs that Fantasy Flight is selling is the Lord of the Rings. That was released in 2011, so it's got quite a few. It's pretty deep into expansions and deluxe editions. Star Wars is still active, but I'm not sure. I haven't heard as much about it.
I'm guessing they abandoned the Games Workshop license so they could keep the Star Wars.
Yeah.
They looked at the money.
I think so. I think that's very possible. And definitely what we've focused on the most is Netrunner. So Netrunner was released in 2012, and I think that's one of the most appealing LCGs just because it's an original IP. It's the Android universe that Fantasy Flight established with their board games, but it's taking from that original cyberpunk setting that the Richard Garfield collectible Netrunner came from. So it's got a lot of appeal because of its originality, and also it's a little bit different than the other card games because it's an asymmetrical game. So you're playing essentially offense and defense. There's a corp and then there's a runner. The runner is a hacker that is trying to infiltrate the corp. So basically a game of Netrunner would have to be two rounds where you play both offense and defense to decide the winner. Game of Thrones got a second edition that they released in 2015. And so Lyle had a little bit of experience with getting on board the first edition shortly after.
I got into the first edition months before the second edition was announced. Right. So,
oh, no.
Yeah.
And then last year was the release of Arkham Horror, the living card game. And so that's a cooperative game, so similar to Lord of the Rings, and it has a nice kind of narrative flavor. So it's Fantasy Flight's Cthulhu mythos. They're Arkham Files.
Yeah.
Some characters that you've seen before in their previous games, and a really nice kind of storytelling, cooperative, deep mystery-solving cooperative game. Not released yet, but coming sometime this year, Fantasy Flight has the license for Legend of the Five Rings, so they will be releasing a LCG based on that IP.
Do you think you'll get into that one, Lyle?
No. No, I don't think I will.
Well, you were a big L5R card fan.
No, I bought a lot of the RPG books, and I thought they were really well done. And then I was trying to decide whether or not to get into first edition Game of Thrones or the Legend of the Five Rings card game. So I bought both, like the starter set for both. We were playing the Legend of the Five Rings card game. There was a lot of similarities between that and Game of Thrones, so I thought it was either or. And then I found out one of the cards in the Legends of the Five Rings basic set was broken. Like, it broke the game to the point where they banned it, except if you only ever played with the basic set. So then I thought AEG, who was producing at the time, just didn't have the quality control to really make a card game. So I thought, nah, I'm out of that. And I went with Game of Thrones and then got burned. Because then they came out with second edition. Really, there were a lot of similarities between L5R and Game of Thrones in the sense that when you attack people, like for example, if you came from Magic, you're used to things like attacking and something blocking and something getting killed. Whereas in both those games, units didn't necessarily die in a combat. There was also important places. Like you have that, you sort of have your backfield. Whereas in Magic, that's entirely your power.
Right.
Whereas there, these places kind of do things, so that they had that.
Mm.
So it was either or in that sense. So
yes.
So they both had a quasi-fantasy feel. They could actually release an L5R game that is quite similar to Game of Thrones. I don't think they will.
Mm.
They don't seem to double up on the mechanics so much, although the Warhammer games were kind of similar.
Yeah.
Certainly, Blood Bowl Team Manager was similar to Warhammer 40K Conquest.
Conquest, right. Yeah, that's true.
Where you wouldn't want to buy both because they felt so similar.
Invasion was very unique in the card placement and kind of defending your citadel or your kingdom.
If I were to guess, I think in all five art, they would play up duels, which was a very different aspect of the miniatures game.
Oh.
So you had some clans that are very good at duels, some clans that were not very good at duels. So they might play that up where you can like put out a card and they can challenge somebody and then shut that person down because they didn't respond to the challenge.
Mm. Yeah, I'm curious. I think that's one of the reasons why I got out of Game of Thrones is just because it felt too much like magic for me. You know, it's still like putting dudes on a field and attacking and kneeling them rather than tapping them. And the locations, they had similar things in magic as well. But, you know, it was a good game. I played it quite a bit, the first edition, but then I sold all my cards and started playing Netrunner.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that's a danger, or that's a kind of a dangerous thing for them to do. I mean, that was, you know, thousands of cards that people had to upgrade when they moved from first edition to second edition. So I hope we don't see too much more of that. I hope there's not a Netrunner 2.0 or a Lord of the Rings 2.0 that invalidates the, you know, previous cards and previous versions.
Well, I think you could still play the game, right? You have a complete card pool and, you know, but at the same time, it was also out for a long time. You know, all these card games eventually end, don't they? All the collectible card games in the past ended for the most part, except for like Magic and Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh, I guess.
Yeah, right. Keep going.
Yeah, they just, and you know, people have their complete card pools. The fans try to invent new ones and kind of keep at it for the most part. But they did introduce cycles with Netrunner because of what happened to Game of Thrones. And, you know, they started the cycle. And once the eighth cycle comes out, they're going to rotate out the first two cycles of Netrunner. You're not going to be able to play with those on a tournament level. We're going to see what happens, you know, if people are going to have a legacy version where everything's okay. But I'm actually kind of excited about it, honestly, because it will really change up the way that we're playing the game. So it also might be a good place for new people to hop in as well.
Yeah, it would be nice if that was kind of future proofing and that prevented them from like a 2.0 update. So yeah, I'm definitely excited about that too, to see how that changes things and how that keeps us rethinking, you know, how we're playing the game.
Those are the games. What should somebody consider when they want to get started in LCGs?
Well, I guess first find an IP that you're really interested in. You know, and if it's a newer game, it's a lot easier to get into.
That's true.
You know, like something like Arkham Horror and L5R, Legend of the Five Rings, are new games, and you can get a core set and follow along with it. Older games are a little bit pricier to get into if you want to play at a competitive level.
Yeah, I think finding another player that's interested in it really motivates you to get on board with buying the new releases and kind of, you know, staying competitive and finding your own meta, like seeing how the other player likes to play and, you know, finding ways to play against them. Everyone shares the same card pool, but everyone can have different strategies for what they include in each of their decks.
Yeah, it's all about having that meta, right? If that meta is not around, it's kind of hard to get into these games. The meta being a community that plays. The community that plays will play certain decks and stuff like that, and that's what keeps you competitive. But if you live in a very rural place, or even living in Japan, for example, it's can be hard to get into these games because they're just not supported here. Or
yeah, I think if you find an IP you're interested in, but there's nobody to play against, it's a little pointless.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people complaining about the Star Wars game. You know, everyone wants to play it. They love Star Wars, but just no one plays it.
Yeah, no one seems to buy that one. Yeah, that would probably be the first one. I mean, certainly, who's playing it? That's the same for any game, with the exception of board games, where you can buy the board game and then get other players to play it. Right. Whereas RPGs and card games, other people just need to buy into it before you can really get into it or to buy it. Unless you're, I mean, sure, with all these core sets, you could actually have more than one deck. You can get somebody and try to hook them, but then they would have to buy in.
That was my only frustration early on with Netrunner specifically, is that multiple core sets were necessary to maintain decks. So when you're doing deck building and you have something you kind of like, but you want to try another idea, you want to try another faction, you want to try different strategies, you don't want to be pulling cards out of decks and kind of swapping things back and forth. So to maintain complete decks that you've created and then move on to something else, you have to have multiple core sets. Because yeah, there's limited, like neutral cards and certain faction cards were limited in the core sets. So that was a little discouraging and kind of soured me a little bit with the LCG model. Is it wasn't totally different from CCG because you're buying into more than one starter set.
Well, that's something I would want to emphasize is some people, when they tried to sell the LCG model, they were saying, oh, it's so much cheaper than collectible card games. And it might be cheaper, but it's pretty small. Card games are pretty expensive. Mm. They're not as expensive as miniature games, but they're certainly more expensive than role-playing games or board games. Mm. And that's just something to factor in. I heard $300 thrown around by one of the designers of the Netrunner game as a realistic price in which to get started. Of course, the person said, yeah, you can just play with the core set, and by all means buy the core set to see if you like the game, play with your friend, see if either one of you likes the game, and then if you don't like the game at all, that's just $30 out of your pocket. But if you actually like the game and you really want to get started and you really want to play with other people that have the game, you're looking at about $300 sounds about reasonable. You won't have all the cards for an established game, but you'll have enough cards in which you can put together a deck that's not going to get crushed every single game.
Right.
I think the best way to go about it is, and you know, that's for like playing competitive and going to store championships. But what do you mean? It really depends on like who's around.
No, I'm going to disagree with you on that. But what you define as competitive. What? Because even in a friendly game, when we look at the players here, I tapped out of our favorite Netrunner, kind of revealing a little bit on the end of this episode. And I'm about one cycle out or two cycles out. But in order to play people who are several cycles deep, you really need to have a pretty substantial card pool, or you're just not going to have the cards in which to compete in a friendly game. So when you say competitive, I hope you mean competitive even amongst your friends. Because if you come with a core set, even amongst your friends in a very casual game, you'll get beat.
Well, I'm not saying that you're just going to come in with a core set and like, you know, win against people that have a lot
but
of cards.
But I think $300 is a realistic thing, and that comes from one of the designers of one of the LCGs.
When I say like competitive $300, I'm talking about going to like store championships, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. But I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about playing with your friends and not feeling demoralized because you lost four games in a row. Because I'm sure we play games to have fun, but we also, part of the fun is winning. Yeah. And you were the most competitive of us, so what are you talking about?
Am I?
So for a competitive game to you, it's just like playing with your son. So what are you talking about? Store championship. And I'm joking. I don't know if you play any of these games with your son. I know you play with your wife, and I know you like...
But I think, yeah, okay, you got a point. Because one of the ways that we talk
I don't people, think we should lie to people.
Yeah, it's a hobby. It's going to cost you money if you want to play it. I put a lot of money into this, but it was over the period of a couple of years, man. Mm. So, you know, if someone wants to get that back catalog, it'll cost them quite a bit up front. Now, one of the ways we recommend going about that is getting the deluxe expansions. Because, you know, if you get like 2, 3, 4 of them, it'll really boost your card pool to the point where you'll have a lot stronger decks.
And to give you an example of what a deluxe expansion means. So for example, with Game of Thrones, which I think even people who don't play these card games at all would be familiar with, a deluxe expansion might be like a house set, or they might provide the House Stark cards or the Lannister cards. For Netrunner, they would provide different factions. Netrunner happens to go with, usually goes with one hacker faction as well as one corporation faction.
So that's kind of how you get into it. You have to buy a core set, multiple core sets, because the LCG model is they only give you one of certain cards, two of other cards, and three of the rest. And you want to have all of them, don't you?
Yeah, most of the decks, you can have up to three copies of a card. So if the core set only gives you one or two.
Now, Arkham did that a little bit differently, you know? So for a deck, you're only allowed to have two of each card in your deck. So what they did with their core set is they only gave you one of each card.
Right.
Are you serious? Because I thought Fantasy Flight was going away with that.
Well, the thing is,
I know the older core sets would have a lot of one-offs. And the idea was, by having one-offs or two-offs, we're going to give you a greater selection. You're not going to have the maximum number of cards you can have of this particular one, but you're going to be exposed to as many cards as possible. And you know something? Yeah, I think with second edition Game of Thrones, they still limited certain cards. So again, the breadth, not the depth.
Well, the idea was those with that model, you had to buy three cores if you wanted all of the cars, if you wanted an entire set of three. With like Netrunner, if you wanted three consoles, Desperado, best console. People use it today. It's like years later. If you wanted three of them, you got to buy three core sets or just print one off and stick it on a Magic card.
That's the difficulty with that model, is it's not until you start playing the game that you realize, wow, those neutral cards or that card that was included, I need three of those. You know, I really, those are very powerful cards. They work well with my ID. They work well with my strategy. I need those cards. And I ran into that with the Warhammer Conquest game as well. It's like they really force you. Their neutral cards are so powerful and they can be used in any faction with any army that you really, you need three cores. That's a real key strategy, and that's a little difficult, and hopefully they get further away from that.
Well, with Arkham, you know, I told you that two of each card in a deck, and they only give you one of each card. You have five characters, so you have five factions in there and a bunch of neutral cards, but the idea was rather than having to buy three cores to get a complete set, you only have to buy two cores to get a complete set. So basically, if you buy two cores, you'll have two of every card.
How generous.
Yeah, but...
Curse you, Fantasy Flight, in capitalist ways.
It works a little bit better than the whole three-core model, doesn't it?
In the same way we were talking about getting into it, finding someone to play with, buying a core set, I think finding an IP that you like, the big trend or the thing that you notice the most from the list of games with Fantasy Flight is that they are all licensed IPs except for one or two. So that's initially attracting people to wanting to play these games. So maybe casual players, people that don't play games, would be interested because it's Star Wars, because it's Lord of the Rings.
As somebody who jumped on quite late to two living card games, both Game of Thrones First Edition as well as Netrunner, one thing I found pretty valuable are sites like Card Game Database, which lists all the cards that are in the set, as well as all the abilities. Like they'll actually show you a picture of the card. And once you play a couple games or a game or two, borrowing a friend's card or with a core set, you might decide that you like certain factions in the game. For example, you might like the Greyjoys in a Game of Thrones, or you might like the Japanese corporation.
Jinteki,
which is very much about damaging the other person as opposed to keeping them out of your servers. And if you like that style of play, then you can go on to something like a Card Game Database and look at the cards that are available and then see that would be pretty cool for my deck. And then you can also find out which data packs in Netrunner or chapter packs in Game of Thrones that you can find those cards in. With Game of Thrones, I never actually bought all of the chapter packs. Eventually with Netrunner, I caught up entirely. So with Game of Thrones, I based it off of Greyjoy and built from there. And then ended up liking Baratheon as well, and then filled in some gaps buying chapter packs that had the Baratheon cards that were really cool, but maybe the Greyjoy cards were sucky, so I hadn't bought them. Yeah. So that's what I would recommend. It certainly helps you get a feel for what's actually out there, and it helps you prioritize your purchases.
Right, right.
Actually, it was a lot easier to do that with Game of Thrones. You know, when we were playing Game of Thrones First Edition, there was a little group here, and we split up the factions. You know, I ended up with Baratheon. Someone else was Greyjoy. Someone else was Lannister. I think the card pool was large enough that I think the game worked well enough that you didn't really mix the factions all that much as I remembered, because I never played with multiple.
Although I did see a Jaime Lannister in a Stark deck.
Yeah, of course.
I'm really surprised that Fantasy Flight hasn't recognized the power or the way that the online card databases really motivate people to want to play the game and want
they
to buy it.
They tried to shut it. Right. Then they backed off.
They did a cease and desist on several
And
card
I think
database.
Probably just based on the idea of the art, you know, of like, you know, they're using copies of the art. But that virtual deck building, I think, is a huge gateway to like wanting to buy more sets and wanting to be in. And you know, so I think that's a powerful aspect of that they're really missing. Yeah, it's a shame because it does make you buy the actual cards because you see the potential, you see what your decks could be when you're building.
It's like
a
catalog, and I don't think they realize that. And Fantasy Flight sent a cease and desist, to Card Game Database, which wasn't directly affiliated with them.
Well, Card Game Database was the one that they bought.
So they ended up buying it.
They bought that one.
And then...
And they tried to shut down all the others.
Wow.
Yeah.
So people would use theirs, so that one wasn't
So they good. Are they officially supporting card game database.
Yeah, they went through a lot of different agreements, and you'll notice now that all the cards have Fantasy Flight Order mark on them. So
that's probably good. Yeah, I mean that's good to see. At least they're kind of waking up. I mean, they are dealing with an analog game, but you can't deny that community is based on the internet, and the mm-hmm. information you get from the game is
internet based. They would have really messed it up if they would have pissed off enough people to get them to stop playing the game because of like their ethics, their mm-hmm. business ethics. You know.
So you have a core set. You found somebody to play with, but I think the one thing that you should always consider, or something to consider, is an IP that you like. I think that's what brings a lot of people into the games, and Fantasy Flight did a good job of licensing a lot of very popular IPs. So they have Game of Thrones, they used to have Warhammer, they have Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, and that really, and then also their Cthulhu, their Lovecraft universe. So I think that brings people in, and people that may not necessarily have thought about playing a card game because of the world, because of the characters, they get drawn into it. And I think that's a good way to kind of entice someone. If you're looking for someone to play with, that's a good way to, oh, you're a Star Wars fan, why don't we try this? You like Game of Thrones, why don't we try this game? It's a good way to find players, and makes it a little bit more accessible, because they do a nice job of the mechanics of each of these games being based in that world. And there's, when they're competitive, those are films that have, or films or properties that have conflicts in them. And when they're cooperative, it fits what you're doing.
It's narrative. I mean, they're just a bunch of cards, but they got pictures, they got flavor text. And after each cycle, it takes you to a new place and introduces new characters, and in a way, even the card games tell a story, and that's part of the fun, that's part of the appeal.
Yeah.
So it's better than me just collecting Topps Marvel trading cards because they're pretty. These are like, I get to collect these cards and do something with them, you know.
Do you think there's room for original IPs in this living card game market? It seems like, aside from Netrunner and the Arkham Ashes. Files. Yeah, Plaid Hat has a expandable card game, Ashes, Rise of the Phoenix, and it more follows, I guess, the Magic model where your two Magic users...
It's got dice, though.
Oh, right. It has a dice mechanic, but it doesn't seem to be establishing itself or as popular as some of these other games, and a lot of their expansions are kind of lagging, more rare to come out.
That's a good question. Because with the living card game, the model is you release a core set, and then every month or every few months you release an expansion. And the so-called cheap aspect of this is that in the expansion, it's just one pack, and you get all the cards in that expansion, and it'll complete a cycle. And like Alan said, it'll try to tell a story, mm-hmm. and things will progress. But with that, you just got to generate excitement. And sure, Netrunner has, even though, I mean, in contrast to the other games, it actually brought the mechanics from the old Netrunner game, Wizards of the Coast Netrunner game, as opposed to buying the IP, because the Android world was something that Fantasy Flight created by itself through its board game. But with a lot of them, like Star Wars or Game of Thrones or Call of Cthulhu, like, you're really pushing things that people know.
Right.
Like, here's the Empire Strikes Back, or here's the Hoth expansion. So then people, I know Hoth, I need that. Mm-hmm. Here's the Boba Fett expansion. I know him, so I need to get that into my thing.
You know, and even at Lord of the Rings, they do tell a lot of original stories within the IP, but this is still based on the original IP. You know, they're still based on characters that you know, but they're not always the stories that were in the books. If you want those, you can get the saga expansions.
So I think with this, if you didn't do an IP, you would have to create right from the core set a very, very compelling story.
Yes.
Or you would have to really play up all the powerful cards that are going to be in this expansion, which runs the risk of breaking the game. Like those powerful cards that you then have to ban shortly afterwards.
Right.
I think that's probably why a lot of them follow kind of the story aspect, is like, we're just adding to the story. Even Netrunner will say, now we're moving to, I think the next one is Mars.
Yeah.
Right. And the last one I actually collected was, now we're moving to India, which was a different place, a different locale in this world. So I want to get these cards just to see how this world unfolds. Like, what's India like in this future?
Definitely. Yeah. I've been reading the books as well.
I mean, we can't really recommend any literature based on an LCG. My god,
they're fun.
One of the worst books I ever read, and I didn't really read it all the way through, was Magic the Gathering book. It was so bad.
The thing is, these Netrunner books, they're not horrible. They're actually pretty fun. And I like how they actually write these books. And this is kind of the way that they develop their setting and their story so they can kind of pump it out through board games, you know. So it's kind of this way of developing the world so they can kind of make it more integrated, more compelling games.
Well, I mean, I love the Battletech series, and a little bit of a tangent, you know, The Expanse, which is, well, it's on Netflix, but it's Sci-Fi Network's. I found out that the book series, in which it's based on, was originally an RPG. The person tried to do an MMO and then shifted to an RPG, like a tabletop RPG. And one of his players was a sort of established author who said, can I use this world to write a book? Mm-hmm. And he said, great. And when he started to write a few chapters in, he's like, I want to write too. So then they wrote it together.
And I think the characters that they were playing in the campaign, they wrote those characters because they had established them. And it's really nice how in the books they alternate between those characters, and it still works. And I think what they would do is write their chapter of their character and then edit the other person's, you know, to kind of give you the, to keep the tone and everything's working well.
Yeah, so definitely crossover can really work. Mm. It tends to work the other way, but certainly it can work through the game down to the fiction.
Yeah, and I think Fantasy Flight's strategy of licensing IPs that people are interested in that are, you know, currently hot, and then building a game with good mechanics that is fun to play, I think is part of their success in getting people hooked into buying these releases of packs and these cycles of cards. Because if you like the IP but the game's no fun, you're not going to continue. So that they do a nice job of kind of matching those. If you're a fan of this, you will like this kind of gameplay. You'll like competitive gameplay. You'll like cooperative gameplay, and hooking people in using the IP, but also making good games.
That's a good point, because the Arkham Horror, which is the latest Cthulhu that they made, making it cooperative actually, I would think, appeals more to somebody who is interested in playing a Call of Cthulhu game or who reads Lovecraft books, because it's all about you versus the strange world around you and the mysteries and unlocking the forbidden secrets.
Right.
So having somebody being the secrets or being the mysteries, it seems to be a bit at odds. So I think it's quite good to make that cooperative. I think it's quite good to make Lord of the Rings cooperative, because you're the Fellowship. Sure, I'm sure there's some people that like to play Mordor. I'm sure there's some people that like to kill cats. But do we sell cards to those people? No. You don't play Mordor. You know, you play the good guys when you do Lord of the Rings. Whereas something like Netrunner, are you more corp? Are you more hacker? That can be, you know, divide people. Some people might vote Republican, some people might vote Democrat. So, I mean, in that case, making that competitive seems pretty inspired.
Mm.
Well, the other good thing about the co-op model that works for Lord of the Rings and Arkham Horror is that, one, you can play it solo. So if you don't have like a community, you can just play it by yourself, which is a lot of fun if you like solo games. Two, if you don't want to play solo, you can still build two decks out of the box. So get a friend. You can play it together, and you could just be like, oh, we're going to do this campaign.
How much does a friend cost, though?
priceless. The other thing with the co-op model, unlike the competitive model, is that you're not as compelled to keep up with the meta.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
Yeah, so if you don't want to worry about keeping up with the latest releases to stay strong against the meta, you know, something like a co-op LCG might be more your thing, because you're just going to buy the chapter packs when you want to do them. And that could be, you know, years later if you felt like you weren't really into it at this point. But
although they call it an adventure card game, Pathfinder releases like a card game. Now, they seem to divide it in primarily into these are like story arc.
Right.
You buy into those.
In a scenario.
So does Arkham Horror do that as well?
Yeah, kind of. So when you buy the core set, you get the core campaign, which is, what is it called? The Knight of the Zealot. And that is three missions. And if you wanted to get the extra missions, you could have side quests as well. You can kind of create your own campaign model. So, but it's basically, it's just three scenarios, and that's your campaign, and you kind of develop your character over that. Now, the first cycle is based off the first expansion, the first deluxe expansion, which will have two scenarios in it, and then there'll be a release of six blister packs, mythos packs, and each one of them is going to be an adventure. You know, this is where it's getting fuzzy here, because some people are all about this model where it's like you need to play them in sequence, right? And some people are like, oh, you can just kind of pick and choose the ones you want to play. It's like, but then that's going to mess up your game. You can't play a full campaign.
Mm. But could I get like the six packs for that particular story or adventure?
Well, so you need the deluxe expansion to be able to play any of those six packs.
Right.
I think you can just pick and choose them and create your own kind of campaign arc. But the way it's looking right now, which is still a little early because the first blister pack, the first miso pack, just came out.
Right.
You know, it looks like you have to play them in order. And if you get like the fourth one, because the first three were sold out, will that cause a problem? I don't know.
Well, I'm not too fussed by that, but I would like to see that these six blister packs are self-contained. So if I decide to skip it, like, you know, it's set in, it's kind of one of those Dagon things with the water, and like, I'm not too interested in that. I can skip that and then go into something that's it's more about the ghouls and, you know, Pikmin's model kind of thing.
Yeah, you can actually, because, you know, you have the deluxe expansion, which is called Dunwich Legacy. The entire campaign, including the following six miso packs, is the Dunwich Legacy.
Okay, that sounds good.
If you don't
good.
Like it, you can skip it and get the next campaign.
Right. Mm. And then you can go to Antarctica or something.
Yeah.
No, I like that. I like that. Yeah. I think that's good. And I think that's certainly more accessible than jumping in onto Netrunner or even at this point, second edition Game of Thrones. I don't know how many are in because I gave up after the core set.
Talking about Arkham Horror, the other thing that they do that's a little bit new that is different from how they handled the Pathfinder adventure card game is they have scaling difficulty. So the randomization is you're drawing tokens out of a bag and that token set can be made more difficult. So adventures can be made more difficult. So I think if you're playing things out of order and you're not necessarily building up your characters and building up experience, you can scale the difficulty of certain adventures to make it more playable, which I think is an interesting idea. It's an interesting approach, and hopefully that will allow people to be non-sequential or kind of, you know, pick and choose, because Pathfinder definitely had an experience curve to it that if you skipped things, there was no way it would be to stay competitive.
That's kind of one of my biggest pet peeves about Arkham is the drawing of the token. Well, you know, as you said earlier, by getting into these card games, into Netrunner is what brought us all together, so
you can make friends.
You can make friends. Now you got your, you picked your IP, you got your core set, you got a bunch of cards. How do you play? What do you do? How do you find other people to play with?
Alan solved that problem for us by setting up a meetup group, a Netrunner meetup group. And so we connected through that. So it's the same
thing. There's a thing called Facebook.
Oh, right. A Facebook.
We got a meetup, Facebook.
Facebook. Yeah. Yes. And so the same way that, you know, you can use the internet to kind of support your knowledge and kind of see what a game does and what it's capable of, that's a way you can also find people to play with. And I think that was a great way to do it. And the thing I noticed right away is that Netrunner attracted a nice, friendly group of people. It wasn't, you know, cutthroat competitive. There wasn't there wasn't anybody that disrupted things or people that wanted you to enjoy the game, so you came back next week.
I think the tournament scene is less in Netrunner. Mm. I think there's a lot more casual players in the sense that they're playing competitively amongst friends. There are people that do go to the tournament scenes, and they are kind of the same people you would meet in Magic who go to the tournament scene. And they got the same social skills as those people that go to the tournament scene. So there's just less of them.
You know? I was never there on those days, I guess. I missed a lot of this.
Well, I follow a lot of the tournament scene, and I listen to some of the podcasts, and for the most part, I think the community is still, you know, it seems like a really friendly, inviting community for the most part. You know, you're right, there are always those type of people. But, you know, even here, we try to create tournaments just to kind of keep us competitive. That's kind of one of the appeals, being competitive, you know, coming back and like challenging yourself to,
I mean, it's hard to say whether or not the game produces less competitive people, because it's certainly not the living card game model. Because I would say just in our tiny group, the Game of Thrones players seem to be a bit more cutthroat and competitive than the Netrunner players.
Well, I think that's
so the Netrunner players itself, are more about
Well, Game of Thrones is a cutthroat game, though, isn't it?
It is. Actually, somebody made a good point. Wayne, who used to be on the podcast, said that in Game of Thrones, people die. Like, you have characters die in the game. Whereas in Netrunner, you don't have people dying so much. I mean, there is death in the game, but it's not like the cards in front of you are constantly dying. So that makes it more personal. And I can see that. So I don't know if that's what it is, but it just seems to be the Game of Thrones players are more cutthroat than what we're used to, whereas the Netrunner players are quite interested to see how something works. I want to see if this way of hacking or this way of protecting my corporation is going to work. I mean, that's just in our small group. I can't say that, you know, Netrunner players are friendlier and more about experimentation, whereas the Game of Thrones player will stab you in the back because they're all Roose Bolton at heart.
Yeah, we're not allowed to play together. We don't play together with the Game of Thrones people.
There tends not to be. I
got in a fight with the
I was one people. Of the. I was a crossover player, and I just tended to enjoy the Netrunner both as a game and the deck building. I found the deck building for Netrunner harder to do at first because it was very much different from something like Magic, whereas Game of Thrones is much more similar to Magic, so you're able to build your deck or understand how to build a deck a little bit more quickly. But once you're able to understand how to build a deck or how to build two decks, because that's what you got to do in Netrunner, then the game itself is simpler, I think. And the game of the mechanics actually support the idea of hacking like very, very well, like much better than Game of Thrones supports combat, because it is really abstract. Like, you're not killing people in the sense that you would think you would kill them. So I just, once I figured out how to build a deck in Netrunner, it just totally changed me from a Game of Thrones player to a Netrunner player. So I just sold off all my Game of Thrones stuff.
Yeah, at least our group was very helpful with the learning curve. I mean, the learning curve of deck building and then becoming a nuanced player, kind of understanding the mechanics, it wasn't discouraging, kind of banging your head against the wall. And I think once you beat that learning curve of Netrunner, you can really start to enjoy it. And I think that, yeah, that worked well in our specific group.
Yeah, and also the thing we did recently, we did a cube draft. So, you know, if you have a complete set, if you have a complete card pool, you could always do a sort of cube draft, and that way you can get other people to play. And you're all on a level field. It's like a regular draft. So if you're drafting cards, you usually open like booster packs or just packs of cards, and you look at them, you choose one, and you pass it to the right, and you get them from the left, and you get to choose your next card. And you're kind of drafting cards. And from the cards that you draft, you're going to, you know, build your decks. But with the cube draft, basically it's a selected card pool, and you just put them all together, and from that, everyone drafts. You don't have to buy any booster packs. You just kind of make it from your own cards. And, you know, that was definitely, for me, I found it really interesting because it was a great way to play with the cards you usually don't play. And it was a great way to kind of, you know, level the field and get everyone creatively thinking on how they can kind of build a deck to be somewhat competitive.
Yeah, I think it was a very interesting test on kind of where you were with Netrunner, because previous to that we had done the single core tournament, and that was kind of the fundamentals and going back to the basics. And the cube draft tournament really kind of challenged you and made you remember certain mechanics or try to make certain combinations work that you've never done before in deck building. So yeah, I think that was a very fun approach.
Yeah, and it was a way to play cards like, you know, these first two cycles are gonna phase out soon, so we kind of focus mostly on those. So it was a great way to kind of play with them again. And you know, if we do a cube draft again in the future, or even if we do like kind of a more of a constructed draft, we might just do the newest cycle, you know, something that everyone has, and just so we can play with more of those cards and see how they work together. So I think it's great way to get more people involved.
That's the nice thing about tournaments, and especially drafting, is you can show up not owning any cards and just knowing the rules of the game, you know, knowing how to play, and then you can kind of see what's going on. And so I think, Alan, you did a good job. We've had two single core tournaments, and you've done a really good job of the people that have just gotten into it and just bought the single core, getting them to play and getting them some experience with a range of different players, because the tournament attracts people outside of our game group and kind of outside of the meta. So you see different play styles, and you get a lot more experience really fast.
Yeah, and definitely people are interested, so they buy that single core. And by making a single core tournament, you give them a place where they can play, you know? So, you know, that's kind of the appeal of doing single core tournaments or setting them up. You know, it's really easy. You just go to a game store, you rent the tables, and everyone get a prize, and everyone pitches in. That's how you have a single core tournament. You know, we talked a lot about this stuff, but, you know, let's get down to the skinny of it. What are your favorite LCG/ECGs? What is your top? We don't play all of them, but I play a bunch. But what are your top threes and why? So starting with number three, who wants to go first?
Number three, I'll go first.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, my number three would definitely be Doomtown. I think that's a game that we've had a lot of fun with. It's got a really nice narrative element. The movement in it, I don't think there is LCG that has the same kind of movement mechanic that really creates a lot of interesting conflict and interesting strategies. So Doomtown would be my number three, and I was sad to see it discontinued, but hopefully we'll see more of it someday.
Yeah, well, actually that's my number three as well. For the same reasons, I love the movement. I found it very similar to Game of Thrones with the locations. You know, you have your location cards and they have their text on it and you can use those locations, but you actually went to those locations and you went to your opponent's location. So the game had this element where you, like a chess-like element, where you're kind of, you're not actually attacking each other at first, you're just kind of controlling the area and putting your people in the right position so that you could kind of plan your attack. And then when you do get in a fight, it's not just a regular attack. You actually set it up that you draw a poker hand, and you both, whoever's involved in the combat, you play a hand of poker, and whoever has the highest rank wins the shootout. Mm-hmm. You know, or they cause casualties to knock out other players. Right. And I loved the mechanics. I thought it was such an interesting game. As you said, it ended pretty soon, although we hear that it's going to come back soon. So
for my number three, I'm not going to put a game that I've played, sorry. I'm going to put a game that's intrigued me of all the games that I haven't played, the one that I would most likely try, and that's Arkham Horror. Because I really like the idea of the self-contained stories. I would want to play a cooperative card game because I already have a competitive card game in the mix. Right. So
we'll set you up with the deck. We'll play a scenario.
I just love how your Jersey accent goes in and out. Set you up.
My number two would be Arkham Horror. I mean, I like the cooperative aspect of it. And unfortunately, I think both of the Warhammer LCG games that Fantasy Flight did were ended prematurely. And because of that, they didn't get to finish the game that they were making. Mm-hmm. So there's real imbalances and things were kind of shortcutted.
And I think it's a good point to raise, because it's a point to raise about LCGs entirely, is that in some cases it seems like they have to reach a certain point before you can say that all the factions are balanced.
Right.
For example, Netrunner, we needed to wait until the final deluxe, not the final deluxe, but the deluxe expansion came, where all the established corporations and hackers.
Wayland's still pretty weak.
Really? I thought that was that changed with last cycle. It's certainly a case, yeah, definitely with the Games Workshop ones, where you couldn't play certain armies. Like, you couldn't play Wood Elves, I think, is a right. faction in Warhammer.
And Skaven, yeah.
And Skaven, but they didn't get enough expansion packs to really make them viable.
Right. Yeah. I think that's difficult. So it's good to see in Netrunner that we're past the point, if you own all the cards up until this month, you still have a very playable game. But there are, that living card game model runs the risk of, if that IP isn't successful enough, if that series doesn't come through, if they just change their focus or lose the license, that they're going to have an incomplete game. So you're going to own a bunch of cards that you're not.
And I wonder if that's part of the model, is having a significant number of factions. So Magic had the different colors.
Right.
Which was five. And we're looking at the Game of Thrones. And of course, Game of Thrones is dictated by its IP. You have all these different houses, but it's more than five. With the Netrunner, of course, you have to collect two at the same time, and it's more than five.
Mm-hmm. There's four corps and three runners.
Right.
And then they have this mini factions, but they don't count.
Right, so seven plus.
Basically, you're going to compare corp versus corp, rather than runner versus runner, you know? Because basically, you're like, oh, this runner faction is the most powerful faction right now, or something like that. It's not going to be among all
of them. In card games, maybe you can't really escape. Do they call it the meta? But you can't really escape that, where one thing is going to be, or even in games, I mean, miniature games are the same. Every time Games Workshop releases a new army book, they're like, oh, now Dark Angels are the most powerful.
Right.
Why am I collecting Blood Angels? Get their book out. Yeah, so it's always going to be the same. I think maybe in RPGs you can probably include all the factions in one book. So
I think that's definitely the strength of Arkham Horror, being cooperative and being more narrative. They're not going to have power creep. They're not going to have, we need the latest pack. So I think that's good. And I like that difference. I like that balance.
No banned list either.
Yeah, right.
So Well, so my number two, actually, I have both Arkham and Lord of the Rings, and it's hard.
You're cheating.
I am cheating.
You're cheating.
So, you know, Arkham is the new one. I love, they're both my co-op games, and I play them both, and but they're just, actually, there's a lot of things that I like better about Lord of the Rings in the gameplay aspects. So
tell us why you like
I'm
going
to say Lord of the Rings. As much as I love Arkham, and I'm backing it, fully backing it, man. I love it, and I love
this
the campaign.
Is solid edition. Number four. Solid number four.
Lord of the Rings, man. You talked about scaling, right? Mm-hmm. So in Arkham Horror, you just add more tokens, so you're more likely to draw a -6, which will kill you. Like, oh wow, that was just random out of the 20 tokens that were in there. Mm-hmm. But with Lord of the Rings, if you want to scale it, they actually have like a little gold ring on some of the cards, and those are the. You, if you want an easier one, you just take those cards out and you got the easy difficulty. If you want a harder one, you have to buy a nightmare pack, which that adds cards to it. And then also the fact when you're doing a battle with the enemy, like you have this shadow card that comes over it and you're like, okay, well, that's the random element, like they're on the token. Well, not necessarily, because it has a shadow ability, which will kind of give a plus or minus modifier to the attack. Right. But you know which ones are in the deck. You know how many there are and which ones have already come out, so you kind of have this idea, and it's not just a number, it's like a thing that happens. Mm-hmm. Like it's like, you know, can't be blocked, or this guy goes back to the deck. And that's way more interesting to me, honestly. Okay. So that's why I like Lord of the Rings, but the campaign and the story and the mechanics are definitely a lot smoother in Arkham.
My number two would be Game of Thrones. I played the first edition, I played the second edition. I played the first edition a lot, and I enjoyed that. The second edition only as far as the core set, and then just had to make a choice between two games. I liked that, I mean, there was three different ways in which you could attack your opponent. There was the power, which is the like kind of like your political power, the intrigue, as well as your military power. So I like the fact, so you could have the Dothraki, which might be strong in military power, and the Dothraki part of the Targaryens, or you could have the Baratheons, which are strong in political power, or the Lannisters, who are strong in intrigue. So it lent itself to an interesting way to play the game, in that you might be strong in one, but weak in another, so how do you defend the other? And yeah, it led to interesting ways to construct your deck. To block against one, or to block against what you're weak at, but to capitalize on what you're strong at. Also, the locations did something. So how many of the locations do you put in your deck? Some of them give you resources, some of them give you abilities. You also, in addition to the character cards, you have event cards in which you can play, which are different abilities. So I think the learning curve really was a bit higher in a Game of Thrones, but it was a lot of fun once you got used to it. It was fun to pit houses that were very different from each other. Like, it was fun to fight Stark versus Lannister. And I think with the IP, I mean, they bought the IP, but then I think they really embraced the IP and tried to do as much as they could so that when you're playing Stark or when you're playing Lannister, you really feel that you're playing that house.
One of the things I really liked about Game of Thrones was the plot cards. I liked, that's one of the things that allowed you to play more than just two people. And it gave you like this special ability. It gave you gold. It gave you initiative. And depending on which one you played at which time, could really help you have an advantage over other players or a disadvantage, but a really good ability. You know, I'm thinking like Netrunner, if we ever want to get more than two players, they'd have to kind of have something similar to kind of do the initiative. The other thing is, I'm wondering, how much does being into the IP have for you to enjoy that game? You know, because you like Game of Thrones, right?
Very much, yeah. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, it's hard for me to separate what I liked about Game of Thrones versus what I like about the actual card game. The art is not amazing. So I wouldn't think that the art would draw you in. Although I wasn't a big fan of Greyjoy prior to playing the game, but they have a mill mechanic, and people who are familiar with Magic, mill means that the opponent has to discard cards at the top of their deck. So Greyjoy had that, which I love the mill mechanic from Magic, so I gravitated towards Greyjoy in Game of Thrones and just kind of went with that. So I think if you like game mechanics that you could, and you could figure them out quite quickly with the Game of Thrones, then you could enjoy that and you can go, hey, they're really good at X. I love X. So I'll play them. But as far as like, I mean, you have character cards. I mean, they're going to mean nothing to you. The flavor text is not enough that you would go, I've got Tyrion Lannister. He looks like a dwarf. He's kind of strong in some things. And the flavor text won't sell you on that. Yeah, and I'll say this for Magic. Magic was able to create flavor from nothing, from that text. And here, really nothing.
So it really does not into the books?
I would say another game, which I'm going to anticipate is going to be mentioned next, does a much better job with flavor text. Because again, like Magic, they have to create the environment, create the atmosphere through the flavor text. Whereas I think with a game like Game of Thrones, they can just lean on, hey, it's Jaime Lannister. You know who Jaime Lannister is. Here's his abilities. And you can go, yeah, that's pretty Jaime. And you'll do that. But everybody else was, hey, it's a blonde knight. He seems to be pretty strong. An attack with my blonde knight named Jaime Lannister. Yeah, I'm gonna attack with him. Brienne. I want to say Brienne is a woman's name. This picture doesn't look like a woman.
I'm the Barthanon faction.
I've got this Barthanon and three kings. What is with that? Because I've only got like. Actually, probably Lannister would be... Gosh, Cersei is going to come out as a queen in that one. Yeah. And then Targaryen, you're like, I just got the one queen. What if I don't like Daenerys? And I'm like, suck it. I'm like, no, this Drogo guy. And then somebody's like, he's dead. And I'm like, no, he's still alive. I've got like three versions of him. one thing, when you play Game of Thrones, like you got like Khal Drogo and Daenerys, and you're like... One of these is dead. I know that. So it kind of like held you up. Do I want to have a deck with Khal Drogo? Because I know he's dead. Spoilers.
Yeah.
Or Ned Stark was like super powerful in first edition. I wonder if he's as powerful in second edition because he's dead. One thing about Game of Thrones, yeah, they do play them at different... You can play cards at different points in history, at least in first edition. You can play them. So you can play Robb Stark as just a lord, which is less than a king, or you can play him as a king, and they would have different abilities, and they might cost a little bit more to cast. And you can play Ned Stark as a king or dead. No, I'm just kidding.
Just put him in your discard pile as soon as he goes into your hand. Put him in play and so you just tap him. He's dead.
Yeah, but I thought they did a really good job. I mean, for example, as far as the abilities, like if you were to play a more Stannis deck and had Melisandre, then you had more like bringing back from the dead and that kind of thing. So they captured that experience. Yeah. What about number one?
Number one. Well, you never forget your first. So my number one is the first living card game I played, which brought us together and kind of got me, you know, into what Fantasy Flight was doing with this. So Netrunner. So it's unique from the other living card games where there is no other asymmetrical card game. The others are factions, you know, against each other, and you're balancing different mechanics, you're balancing different abilities. But Netrunner, you alternate playing offense and defense. And that's really refreshing. It actually keeps you playing because when you're frustrated or you're not making any progress or you have built a terrible runner deck, you might have some success with your core and you know, not feel like you're just being defeated over and over again. And I think that variety is really nice. And also playing both sides of it, you're learning what you're playing against, you're learning what you have to build for, so I think it's unique in these living card games, that asymmetry, and I really enjoy that. And playing the game educates you differently than a lot of the other games where you're like, I play these factions and I'm going to do or die with this strategy.
Right. No, I agree. My number one is Netrunner, and different from you, it wasn't my first, and that was Game of Thrones. I just, when I first played Netrunner, I went, I don't really like the hacker versus corp theme, but if I like this cyberpunk kind of theme, the mechanics actually are much better than a Game of Thrones in support of the theme. And then I just kind of came around. It was just a better card game. So I really like that for the same reasons that you do, in that we got together. Number one. Two is, it forces you to play two very different styles of game. And that, again, forces you to understand what's going to happen when you're playing your defense or your offense. Like, what are you going to face? Yeah, like, again, like you said, you can actually be a pretty terrible runner player or a pretty terrible corp player, but you might actually be okay at the other one. So you might walk away with the game having a draw because mm-hmm. you were good at one, at least one of those sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is motivating, and we can't de-emphasize that and say like, as long as you had fun. But people do have fun and when they do reasonably well, even if they lose and are competitive in that loss. And mm-hmm. and with Netrunner, it comes down to a thing called agenda points, which the corporation has, but the corporation can score, but the hacker is trying to steal. So, I mean, you could have a game like 7-6, which is a lot better than something like Magic, where you're dead, not dead, you know? So there it's like, wow, I was so close. You know, I felt like I was a turn away from winning. So I can really feel that I might be able to win next game. Mm. Yeah, no, I do like that. Although you can be killed in Netrunner.
But. You can. And that's also... Spoiler. Not spoiler. My number one was Netrunner as well. And a lot of it has to do with theme mechanics, the asymmetry, what you guys have already said. But also, I think even if you had like an okay runner, if you're not like great, there's always that chance, right? You know, you could just dig into R&D and pull an agenda off the top.
There are Hail Marys in this game. Yeah, definitely. Where people can turn it around. I mean, when you're looking at a game like Game of Thrones or Magic, and you're down a lot of lives, or you have no cards left on the table, you're dead in those games. Where here, you can come back mid-game or late game and have a lucky run. So if you got a gambling instinct or you really like the idea of the quarterback throwing a Hail Mary, then definitely you will like a Netrunner.
Yeah, yeah.
You were like a Netrunner.
Yeah. It's a good game. And, you know, if you just want to get a taste of it, this new deluxe expansion might be your thing if you're a casual player. And who knows, if you like it a lot, you might want to dig a little deeper.
I wonder if the fact that the Netrunner is the closest to an original IP that they have makes it special for Fantasy Flight games. And that's why they're debuting, I believe, this legacy idea with Netrunner.
Well, it's the first of its kind to come out for any LCG, any competitive LCG.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to be exciting.
They must feel confidence in that can't be taken away from them. There can't be a licensing battle. They can't be at the end of a contract and, oh, great, now this is gone.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, they definitely felt that with Warhammer, that they left, you know, Conquest incomplete. And they had, they had a great series of RPG books and stuff that are just never going to see any future editions.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. So, and one reason why Netrunner is number one for us is that this might actually be a good time to jump on. You'll certainly be able to enjoy the core set a little bit more than we did, in that it was just the core set.
Mm-hmm.
Where here you might be able to buy a core set and another set. So the initial payout is a little bit more. You're probably looking at, what, $60?
For the expansion?
The core and the legacy expansion.
Yeah, 60, 70, depending on where you get it.
Yeah, about $60 as opposed to the $30 that we would have paid. But you're going to get a better game experience. And then you'll have a more informed choice of whether or not you want to continue.
Mm.
And if you don't want to continue, you still got a pretty playable game, I guess.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Right.
What would be your suggestion? What would be your advice for doing that? I mean, that we found each other online, so that's probably a good place to start. Facebook groups.
There's plenty on Meetup. Just talk to your local game stores. Go on to different forums. There's a pretty strong community on Reddit. There's the Netrunner.
Yeah, just because we said it was number one doesn't mean we sold everybody. Definitely visit your local gaming store. I mean, whether or not... I mean, it's a good idea to buy something from the local gaming store just to support them. But that's where you're going to meet your players. I mean, one thing about card games over role-playing games, which I think are cheaper to get into. One thing about card games over role-playing games is it's easier to bring card games to work.
Yeah.
That's and then bust those out as opposed to, hey, here's a 350-page rule book. what do you think you might be interested in?
Yeah, recruiting coworkers is definitely a strategy, yeah. And with a card game, that's much more...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but, you know, just hop online, see who plays.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Go out and meet people. All right, I think we're going to wrap it up there.
Yep.
Everyone, thank you very much for joining us.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs. Thank you.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.